It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today we're traveling in Vietnam. Our guide is native and food expert Mai Pham. She paints a portrait of a country that's at peace for the first time in a century and of a cuisine that is the liveliest and freshest in all Southeast Asia. She brings us the street life, the street food, and the home cooking of Vietnam. Back here, Jane and Michael Stern take us into an episode of The Sopranos in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Anya von Bremsen of Travel and Leisure magazine is a woman of courage. She has the nerve to name the best pizza in America. And we go into the woods for the Feast of Audacious Souls. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide to nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. I was thinking the other day about how at this time of year, you don't need to do much to foods. So many things taste great raw or barely cooked. If you use too much heat or too many ingredients, you hide the incredible goodness of things like prime tomatoes or melons or nectarine or corn. But there are flavoring tricks, ways to accent what is already good, and some ways to liven up and brighten the tastes of things that just might be a little dull. So here's a few flavoring tips to use for fresh summer produce. Now, the first thing to remember is opposites do attract, and they can make that opposite flavor taste even better, especially when you're talking about sweet and tart. For example, when you get some really good corn on the cob, try this. Set off its sweetness with a blend of lime juice, chili, and salt. Now, you don't need much, but that tart, hot, and salty blend makes the corn taste sweeter and lusher. Salt is key with anything sweet. It makes it taste better, and it seems to heighten sweet flavors. So try salt and maybe a dash of lemon or lime on fruits that are in their prime. Just like with the corn. Now, don't overdo it. Just a little. But this combination will perk up peaches and melons and plums, most of the fruit family. Another thing to remember about really delicious fruit is that heat mutes its flavor. So if you're going to cook a good peach, for instance, caramelize it fast and ruthlessly. Now, that browning brings a whole new kind of flavor to the party. And it's pretty good topped with a little vanilla ice cream, kind of like a summer sundae. So how do you do ruthless caramelizing? You need fruit to be close to the heat, like a broiler or the bottom of a hot saute pan. Also, you should know that fat and sugar accelerate caramelization. Now, this means that the fruit keeps most of its raw goodness while the part nearest the heat gets a delicious crusty brown glaze. So here's the details. Melt a little butter with two key ingredients. You add a drop or two of almond extract because it brings out good things in stone fruits like peaches and nectarines. Also, add a pinch of salt because that heightens the sweetness. Cut your fruit in half. Brush it with the butter and sprinkle it with just a haze of sugar. Have it up close to the broiler or cut side down in a hot saute pan until it browns. Then serve that fruit topped with ice cream or just streak it with some cool heavy cream. While we're talking about fruits, I just learned something from John Rowley. He hunts down exceptional fruit for a chain of markets in the Northwest. He said nectarines and peaches are at their peak of sweetness when the yellow part of the skin turns a real rich gold. Now, I found that even nectarines that you've left out in a basket, you know how you leave them out too long and they start to wrinkle a little? Well, at that point, if they were good to begin with, they can taste absolutely wonderful, kind of like a lush, sweet, concentrated wine. There's another whole realm of summer eating that we all like, the raw tomato dishes, the salsas, the uncooked pasta sauces, the tomato salads, and almost always you team the raw tomatoes with raw onion and garlic. Well, sometimes that raw onion and garlic can be so strong it kills the dish. To tame the onion family down, you need a little acid. Sprinkle them with vinegar or citrus juice and just let them sit for 20 minutes. You'll end up with all the flavor, but none of that brash, overwhelming heat. Now, the other trick with raw onions, if you want to keep them crisp, is bury them in ice water for about 20 minutes. They'll get nice and mild. So, play opposite flavors against each other, tame down your onions and garlic, and join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, the place you can register for Target's own kitchen essentials, hard anodized cookware from Calphalon. It's professional quality heavy cookware with tempered glass lids and ergonomic handles. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and is distributed by PRI Public Radio International. Today, it's traveling and eating in Vietnam. Our guide is Mai Pham. She's a native, a restaurateur, and she's the author of The Pleasures of the Vietnamese Table. She's going to tell us what we need to understand, what we don't want to miss eating, and all about street life. Anya von Bremsen, who writes about food scenes all over the world for Travel and Leisure magazine, loves to live dangerously. She's tracked down what she thinks is the best pizza in America. And I'd like all the emails to go to Anya. They call it the Feast of Audacious Souls. It's an all-night bacchanal in an undisclosed location deep in the Vermont woods. Think drums, think mulberry wine, think spit-roasted game. We will have a report. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to open the lines for your calls. That number is 800-537-5252. Well, Jane and Michael Stern are ready to check in. They write the road food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, we're going to do something we don't normally do, and that's take you to a place right near where we live in Connecticut. We're going to Bridgeport, Connecticut, which is probably, maybe 15 miles from our house, to a place called Ralph and Rich's. And I'll tell you, you will think you have entered an episode of The Sopranos when you eat there. Well,
I gather it's Italian then, right?
It's Italian. Bridgeport is a very colorful city, let's put it that way. To get to Ralph and Rich's is an experience unto itself, because the only parking is in a parking structure that is above the downtown Greyhound bus station, through which you have to walk in order to get to the restaurant.
Or take the world's scariest unoccupied elevator. Then you run screaming down the streets of Bridgeport until you find the sanctuary of Ralph and Rich's, which is this wonderfully cool, air-conditioned,
dark
bar in the front, kind of lovely, airy veranda-style patio almost, although it's enclosed, dining room in the back. And the minute you walk through the doors there, you are taken care of by the maitre d', who knows everybody. And this is where all the lawyers eat, all the movers and shakers of the town of Bridgeport eat. Anybody who is anybody eats there. It is the most sublime Italian food and, oddly enough, very inexpensive.
What kinds of stuff are they serving?
Nothing exotic. I mean, wonderful pastas, you know, with bolognese sauce. We had a fabulous, what was that polenta that you had?
I had grilled polenta with just a classic ragu sauce on it, just a really hearty meat bolognese sauce. And just grilled polenta and a gorgonzola salad.
Lasagna is
lasagna
wonderful.
Was terrific.
It's very motherly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. it's kind of almost 1950s Italian. I don't think I actually saw meatballs and spaghetti, but I guarantee you, if you asked for them, they would make it for you. Everything is the bread is delicious. The waitresses who serve you, treat you like a regular, even if they haven't ever seen you before. You know, you're called hun, you're called darling, you're called sweetie pie. But there's a lot of sass and attitude there. But the food is just wonderful. And the entrees, I mean, this enormous, wonderful chicken piccata or a lasagna or a manicotti is $6.95. And you're sitting, you know, kind of in the middle of Connecticut's most major urban metropolis, you know, with all the lawyers and their ties and jackets and, you know, people who look like they do construction or waste management for a living. And yet the tab is very low and you feel like you are family.
And one of the great things about Ralph and Rich's is that if you're a single diner, they have a long bar in front and it's just so great. I remember the first time we walked in, you walk in and you get a view of the whole long bar and they're sitting at the bar where maybe 8 or 10 guys, each alone, each sort of forking into a great big bowl of spaghetti. It was such a wonderful sight.
Is it a big place?
No,
it's a little place. I'd say the dining room is maybe, 100 feet by 100 feet.
I don't think it holds more than 40 or 50 people. Mm-hmm. It's for the cognoscenti of downtown Bridgeport.
And it's the kind of diner who calls the red sauce on their lasagna gravy. I mean,
this is not the shishi hoo-ha.
Definitely not.
This is the old time. I hear you.
All right, old downtown funky
Italian American
food. But we've never had a meal there that we didn't just adore. And for Michael and I to park above the scary Greyhound bus station in Bridgeport and run in terror 5 blocks through the mean streets of Bridgeport to safety to eat lasagna, has to be that good.
Also, we know you do not work for the Chamber of Commerce. Thank you both very much.
We'll be hearing from Bridgeport.
We work for nobody but our stomachs.
Take care, you two.
Happy eating.
Gene and Michael Stern are authors of Square Meals, America's Favorite Comfort Food Cookbook. Every week you can hear them here on The Splendid Table, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to our website, splendidtable.org. Yvonne Bremsen is contributing food editor to Travel and Leisure magazine, and she often comes by The Splendid Table. The world is literally Anya's beat. She's told us about Shanghai, the boomtown, Spain's new wave of cooks, and where to find good eats in Ireland. But lately she's been staying closer to home. Anya, it's good to have you back.
Thanks, Lynn. Pleasure.
Now, you're always taking us across some kind of ocean, but I want to talk about an article that you did recently about pizza, not in Italy, but in America. Okay, so what did you do?
Well, essentially, it was for our family issue of Travel and Leisure for people with children, and we decided to do a roundup of the very best pizza houses in America because that's what everyone wants to find.
So what did you discover?
Well, of course, there are classics that you absolutely cannot miss. There's New York has Lombardi's, which claims to be America's oldest pizzeria, started in 1905. It moved from its original locations just a couple of doors, but it still does pretty much the best pizza. It's cold, burning oven. You know, the crust is just so expressive. It literally sings in your mouth. The toppings are all American, Italian, you know, great pepperoni. And it, the place is just a pleasure to be in. And for some reason, it's still not on the tourist circuit. People know about it, but, you know, they go to other places. So it's really just incomparable, you know, real Little Italy, New York experience. Yeah, the other mecca for pizza is Frank Pepe's Pizzeria Napoletana in New Haven. That some would argue that that is the pizzeria in America because, you know, pizza and New Haven have a very close relationship. That's where a lot of immigrants from southern Italy came at the turn of the century. They started selling what then was called tomato pies from little wagons. And Pepe is an absolute classic. And next door to Pepe is Sally's, which is another classic. And there's a huge debate in New Haven which one is better. And the styles are a little bit different, but I would suggest, you know, doing both. And the other discovery, and I think that's really certainly my favorite pizza in America, is of all places in Phoenix, Arizona. You would not imagine, but it is. And it's a place called Pizzeria Bianco. And its owner, Chris Bianco, he's a Michelangelo of pizzaiolos. He is such a fanatic. Just imagine, he uses spring water, special organic flour, expensive salt from Brittany. And, you know, he does each batch himself. It's, you know, it's just the ultimate sort of non-mass produced boutique pizza, and I don't think you'll find any better of that style of kind of thin-crusted new wave pizzas.
What about the South, Anya? I never associate pizza with the South.
Well, one doesn't, that's true, but there is a wonderful place in Atlanta, Georgia, and it's called CK's Grilled Pizza, and it's very unorthodox. They the owners started the place by just grilling pizzas on their, you know, outdoor barbecue, which everyone has, and they sort of came up with the idea, bam, you know, that's going to work. And they were almost laughed out of town. People were just going, what is that? And then they won the best, the big pizza competition in Las Vegas and became sort of heroes, and the place was mobbed, and they opened another one. And it's actually a great idea. I don't know if you'd agree, you know, because it picks up the smokiness and It's very nice for the texture.
Where else?
Well, of course, you have to mention Los Angeles and, you know, the whole genre of the thin-crusted pizza topped with gourmet ingredients belongs to Wolfgang Puck, who started doing, you know, the creme fraiche and smoked salmon pizza at Spago. But there is a place called Angeli Cafe, which is just, you know, this very elegant kind of urbane place for Italian food. And the owner there, they do very interesting things. They let the kids play with their own dough. So they roll out the dough, then it's whisked to the oven, and it comes back to you. So she's kind of training a generation of pizza makers. And the
kids actually roll out their own dough?
Yes.
That's great.
It's the ultimate interactive experience.
Hey, thank you.
Pleasure.
Okay, everybody, send the email directly to Anya. Anya von Bremsen is contributing food editor to Travel and Leisure magazine, and she's the author of the award-winning book on Russian food, Please to the Table. You can get Anya's pizza picks on our website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, inside Southeast Asia's freshest cuisine, into the Vermont woods for the all-night feast of Audacious Souls, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. Vietnam is becoming a tourist destination. But because of our shared history, this may not be as simple as just calling a travel agent and making reservations. For some insights, we're going to talk to Mai Pham. Mai is chef owner of Lemongrass Restaurant in Sacramento, California. Mai was born in Vietnam and raised in both Vietnam and Thailand. Now she goes back to learn about her culture, and she brings groups of food professionals to Vietnam. Her new book is The Pleasures of the Vietnamese Table, Recipes and Reminiscences from Vietnam's Best Kitchens, Markets, Street Cafes, and Home Cooks. Mai, welcome.
Hi, Lance. Nice to be here.
Mai, I'd like to start with an overview. What do you think those years of war did to the food traditions in Vietnam?
Well, for my family, for example, the war went on for a long time, for 100 years. When you consider the recent history of Vietnam, you have to remember that after the Chinese occupation in Vietnam, much earlier on in history, for 2,000 years, the French came and occupied and ruled Vietnam for almost 100 years, from the from 1858 on to 1954. And right after that, there was a short moment where the country was divided into two, and then the Vietnam-American War, as it is called over there, started, and that, of course, lasted until 1975. And so I think what that did was it made people put cooking aside and just focus on everyday survival. And so for people like my grandmother, who today is 102 years old, and by the way, going to be 103.
Congratulations to her.
Yeah, don't you think? And, you know, she never knew peace until now. And so one of the most fascinating things about traveling to Vietnam is to see the country within that context, that this is the first time in 100 years that Vietnam is enjoying peace.
Well, Mai, let's talk about traveling in Vietnam. What should we expect? I mean, what will we see?
Well, it's a beautiful country. And to me, the value of Vietnam as a travel destination right now is that it has such charming landscapes, very natural. Things that you won't see, like some of the pictures that I've taken of Vietnam. Sometimes when I come back, I can't believe that I was actually there. I can remember this one image where it is a mining town up in the north Vietnam section, outside of Hanoi, where there are barges coming down the river. There are beautiful limestone mountains in the background in different shades because of the way the sun was setting. Mm-hmm. And in front, homes that are handmade of stone, and it looks like it's been there for at least 500 years. And you see this all over Vietnam, particularly in the north.
What about the street life? I have this image of everybody's out in the street, just from photographs I've seen.
Indeed, and that's why you go to places like Vietnam. If you're interested in the food, you're interested in the culture, you want to know how people live, this is how you do it. You just walk down busy streets. In Hanoi, there are sections of the town where, when I'm there, I always try to get up about 4 or 5 a.m., and you see older women, grandmothers sweeping the street, cooking food to take to the market. In the morning, sometimes in Hanoi, at 4 or 5 o'clock, you wake up, open the door,
windows to your hotel room, and you can hear the sound of all the sandals just flopping on the street. People are just walking really fast, going to the market. And that's life in Vietnam. That's daybreak in Vietnam. It's a totally different kind of culture where everyone, homes are small, it's warm there, windows are open. And so you walk down any street, any alleyway, and really see Vietnamese life up front, up close.
Well, let's talk food. What should we not miss? Now, I realize there's a panorama of food there, but some highlights of what not to be missed.
Well, you certainly cannot miss having a perfect, and I mean a perfect, bo of pho, which is the Vietnamese beef noodle soup. I spent 6 years looking for the best noodle shops in Vietnam, and every time I go back, there's always a new place where I'm excited about. But definitely anything out at the markets, on the streets, and definitely my personal favorite, anything has to do with rice noodles. One of the things I always do when I go to Vietnam is go to the main market right in Saigon and eat bún thịt nướng, which is rice noodles with grilled pork and fresh herbs, and you just toss them up lightly. It's a dish that's served at room temperature. It has noodles, fresh herbs, crunchy and cool cucumbers, and you drizzle this nước chấm, which is the quintessential seasoning sauce, like a dressing, on top of this bowl, and you toss it gently, and you eat, and you're in heaven.
Okay, but first of all, I have to tell our listeners that pho, we've seen it on Vietnamese menus, but it's spelled P-H-O, so it's a little tough to know how it's pronounced. So, should we be concerned about eating street food and maybe raw vegetables?
Yes, people are always been advised not to eat anything that's not cooked in Vietnam. And for the most part, that's probably a good advice since, you're not used to eating. But when we go to Vietnam and take the tour, the CIA, the Culinary Institute of America tour to Vietnam, we always wash our own fresh herbs in the hotel room with, the hotels usually have filter water. And then we sanitize it with, we call it the purple pill, which is something that you take. Actually, you can buy them at camping supply stores, and you wash it, and we bring our own herbs everywhere we go. And so when we have our pho in the middle of the street there, we would dig into our own personal, supply of fresh herbs. And if you go to Vietnam and you're interested in food and you're worried or scared you won't eat the fresh herbs, you haven't been to Vietnam.
My, this sounds wonderful. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Mai Pham is chef owner of Lemongrass Restaurant in Sacramento. Her latest book is Pleasures of the Vietnamese Table. Mai left us her recipe for lemongrass beef on cool noodles. You can get a copy on our website, splendidtable.org. Every summer, a group of old high school friends gather in the woods in southern Vermont. They come together for an all-night feast. It's done with a tad of mockingly medieval ritual. This year, reporter John Kalish attended along with a New York City character named Jim Leff, who runs the ChowHound.com website.
Late on a weekday afternoon in early August, the feasters gather in a small clearing on the edge of the woods. There's a barbecue pit dug in the ground, and over a fire, people are cooking vegetables, chicken, and a deer that had the grave misfortune of making a nuisance of itself at a nearby farm. Chowhound Jim Leff has seen all kinds of food in his travels, but this is the first time he's seen a deer barbecued.
That deer is looking really, really anguished.
When darkness falls, the feasters don handmade masks and begin making their way along a thin path that snakes through the woods. Jim Leff has a ridiculous pointy paper bag hat on as he makes his way along a candlelit path which is lined with wood shavings. Besides being a professional food writer, Leff is a working musician and he's got his trombone with him.
People are carrying various charred animals on spits up a path lined with what looks like shaved Parmesan cheese, carrying torches and pounding on Robert Bly drums. Are we supposed to whoop as we walk? I'm not sure. I've never been sure of that.
Whoop! Whoop! Whoop!
A couple of hundred yards into the woods, we come to a large clearing. There is a gong fashioned out of an old oxygen tank and a long red banner hanging from trees. Long tables are covered with an incredible array of homemade food. Adding to the visual drama is the fact that two of the founding feasters are wearing hooded robes.
Edacious, have they brought meat?
They have brought meat.
I see the light.
They have brought light.
Ah, looks good. Is there a knife?
He or she with a knife better fork it over now!
Edacious souls have gathered now 31 years. It is good.
It is good.
Enter.
It is good.
The inner sanctum.
It is good.
And let the feast begin.
Feast again.
That would be so much more effective if they'd write their dialogue ahead of time, don't you think?
Welcome to the Feast of Edacious Souls, which has been taking place for 31 years on the family property of Tim Virick, who now lives in New Mexico. Back in 1970, during his senior year in high school, Virick decided that he and his friends would put on a feast loosely modeled after a hippie gathering his cousin had been doing every Thanksgiving on a small island off Connecticut. Consult a dictionary and you'll find that edacious is an adjective that means voracious.
I sat up till like 2 o'clock in the morning in my bed with a thesaurus. And, you know, I actually came across the piece of paper that I had that night a couple of years ago. And it had all these different names that I had thought of. You know, basically it was the Society of Gluttonous Persons.
With the exception of a knife used to cut barbecued members of the animal kingdom, there are no eating utensils allowed at the feast. Plates and napkins are also forbidden. So the bread, salads, and desserts are all scooped up by hand.
What's your name?
I'm Jim.
Jim, I'm Sonia.
How do you do? I'm good. That's more than enough.
Really May the wings of liberty never lose a feather.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Mulberry. Mulberry. Oh, this is delicious.
In addition to the mulberry wine, a feaster named Clayton from Massachusetts pours apple, cherry, and rhubarb wine, all home-brewed. A guy known as Pug, who is a proud libertarian, introduces us to Ed Paquin, an original member of the Council of Edacious Souls. Paquin has only missed 3 feasts in the last 30 years.
It's a thing to look forward to. You can see Tim likes to have a touch of ritual to it. And I think that's, you know, it just kind of makes it something that's a little bit different than getting together with the boys for a beer or something like that, you know? It sets it apart.
Of course, when these boys get together, it's for more than just a few beers.
I'm hoisting a barbecue turkey leg, which is actually very, very good. Want a bite?
That's such a big glad pub.
And what are you drinking? McNeil's beer, which is good. Proud brew pub from Brattleboro.
McNeil's beer is so good that a guy named Chris, who plays upright bass in the Feast Jam, has difficulty remaining upright.
I got it.
Under a lean-to not far from a campfire, the regulars are playing guitar, fiddle, and various forms of percussion. Mr. Chowhound, a jazz musician who often plays Hasidic weddings, is persuaded to take out his trombone and join the intoxicated ensemble. The feast is different every year, and not all the regulars make the annual trek to the woods of southern Vermont. Jacques Irons of Fairbanks, Alaska, attended the first several feasts. This is the first feast he's come down for in more than 20 years.
What's really cool about it is that it's been going on for 31 years, and there's a lot of things in the world that have not had that kind of longevity.
For the Splendid Table, I'm John Kalish at the Feast of Edacious Souls in Vermont.
I see my hometown's coming inside. Everything got everything.
Reporter John Kalish and Chowhound Jim Leff work and eat in New York City.
I love you too.
The lines are officially open for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have Paul on the line. Hi, Paul. What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn.
Hi. What's happening?
Well, I have been trying to come up with a recipe and find a recipe for poached pears that either involve infusing them with herbs like thyme or lavender and honey or tea. And I've tried a few times, and it keeps coming out bitter.
Bitter? Tell me what you're doing. Let's start there.
Well, I start by, you know, putting some water into a pot and adding some sugar, making, you know, like a simple sugar or something.
Right, a syrup, right.
A little syrup. Mm-hmm. And then I've been adding lavender blossoms and some honey.
Sounds lovely.
And a little bit of vanilla bean.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, peeling pears and poaching them. And it comes out slightly acrid. It doesn't taste very good.
Well, you know, you may be using too much of the lavender.
That may be it.
How much are you using?
Well, I probably use a tablespoon.
Oh, gee, that doesn't sound like it's going to be a problem.
No, or if I use thyme, I'll use a few sprigs.
Yeah.
Fresh.
You know what I wonder? Is it coming out tasting like bitter pear? You know, is it like an unripe pear, or is it really tasting like an off flavor that isn't coming from the pear?
Just an off flavor. It doesn't taste like the pear. It tastes just bitter. It's not pleasant. But I know it's possible. I just have never seen a recipe for it, and I've looked all over in lots of books.
You know, one place to look, and I'm not sure if you would find exactly this, but you'd certainly find an awful lot of great ideas and new ideas for working herbs into desserts, is Jerry Traunfeld's book, The Herb Farm Cookbook. Jerry, you've probably heard Jerry on the show.
I have, definitely. He's from the Northwest here where I live.
Oh, where are you?
I'm in Seattle, Washington.
Oh, yeah. He's right in your neighborhood. The thing about him, Paul, is his recipes are wonderful, and a lot of them very simple, and he's doing a lot of new ideas. Like, for instance, he will take the fresh herb and throw it in a blender with the sugar that might be sprinkled over something. Hey, I have got a dynamite idea. Let's back up on this. I'm not sure what's going on with the poaching, but why not do this? Why don't you poach your pears in something like white wine and honey and a couple of vanilla beans and some sugar if you want. But get that syrup really intensely flavored with the vanilla and simmer it and get it nice and sweet and simmer it about 10 minutes or so. Then put the pears in and poach them. Okay? Let them sit overnight in that syrup. Drain off that syrup, and then what you do is take white sugar and take the blossoms, maybe just a teaspoon or so of the lavender blossoms. Make sure they smell wonderful, you know, really fragrant, because lavender gets old.
Yeah.
And it can get that, it can be almost bitter. And what you do is puree that together in the blender so you get lavender sugar. And I would serve the pears sliced, fanned out on a plate, and lightly sprinkled with that sugar.
Oh, that's a great idea.
So you'll get the fresher taste. And do that with green herbs as well. Try that with fresh basil and the sugar. It can be great.
So then we don't have to worry about cooking it and making it bitter.
Exactly. Sidestep the whole thing. The vanilla is always going to be softening and lovely and delicious in the syrup. But that's the way I would try it. You'll also get a brighter flavor, and that's a pure Jerry Traunfeld kind of trick.
Thanks a lot, Lynn.
Plagiarize here, you know.
That's
we don't
good.
Fool around. Hey, Paul, thanks. And call us and let us know how it works.
I will. Thank you very much.
Okay. It's time for trivia, my weekly food question. This one's thanks to Bon Appetit magazine. Okay, the question is, what's the liquor that comes with a worm in the bottle? Now, it's not what everybody thinks it is. Again, what is the spirit that comes with a worm in the bottle? We'll have that answer in a moment and more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We have open lines for your calls this hour, so give us a ring. The number is 800-537-5252. But before I get back to the phones, I've got the answer to this week's food question. It was inspired by Bon Appetit magazine. Here's the question. What is the liquor that comes with a worm in the bottle? Now, it's not what everybody thinks. It's not tequila. It's mezcal. Now, mezcal's related to tequila. Evidently, the way you make tequila is you take this cactus called the agave and you ferment it a couple of times. Well, one of those first fermentations makes mezcal. And to make mezcal a little bit more attractive, they put a worm from the cactus in the bottle. Supposedly, it's going to give you hallucinations. Well, I wanted to find out how you drink mezcal, so I went up on the web. And this is what I discovered. I came across all these cures that you use mezcal for in Mexico. For instance, you have a high fever, you rub the person with mezcal. You have a toothache, use mezcal. Just hold it in your mouth, on the tooth, and then you swallow it, of course. But here was my favorite. If you're bitten by a scorpion, first of all, find the scorpion. Break off its tail, throw that away. Eat the scorpion. Take a cold shower. Drink a large glass of mezcal. Now, I want you to understand that the Splendid Table does not endorse any medical advice. And now we'll go back to the phones. That number is 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see. Who is up? We've got Ben on the line. So, Ben, what do you want to talk about?
I have a question about ice cream.
Oh, okay, okay.
We have a restaurant here in Hood River, and we make ice cream, and we have a little debate amongst the chefs in the kitchen over the recipes for gelato and ice cream. And so we thought you might be the authority to tell us in terms of eggs and cream, cornstarch versus other thickening agents, and that's what we wanted to know.
So you've been trying gelato recipes as well as ice cream recipes.
Well, I hate to say that we've been trying one particular or another, because when I think of ice cream, I think of a classic creme anglaise that's just slowly frozen.
Meaning a custard, an egg custard that you freeze.
Frozen custard.
Right.
But we can't find anything definitive because everybody's got something different and everybody has a different opinion, too.
Well, that's because if you're trying to figure out what gelato is and it comes from Italy, you'll never get an exact definition. It defies the Italian mentality. This is what I know, and this is not necessarily at all definitive.
Okay.
There are two kinds of ice cream. Ice cream falls into two basic categories. One is custard base, what you're describing, the creme anglaise, which is a custard of egg and milk and flavoring of some kind. That's usually referred to as French ice cream. It's the French style. Then there is just milk or milk and cream with flavoring that's put into an ice cream machine. That's also ice cream.
So you're just saying frozen milk.
Well, frozen milk, usually with cream, too, or just cream and a flavoring, like peaches or chocolate or whatever. Gotcha. That's also ice cream. If you go to Italy, gelato changes, its basic formula changes as you go from one area to another. Generally in the south, like Sicily, with the ice cream experts, they will throw the starch in instead of eggs, let's say. Or heavy cream, because they're in a very hot climate and the spoilage is less. And they just have a tradition of a little bit of starch of some kind.
Okay.
If you go further north, generally it's about milk and flavoring, not eggs. Now I say that, and yet I know there are gelato makers in Italy who make an egg custard and make gelato. But generally, gelato is made with milk, 4 to 5%, 2 to 3%, whatever the percentages of fat in milk.
Okay.
And some kind of intense flavoring, and it's served soft.
Mm-hmm.
It's every time you say something that's definite in Italy, there's an exception, but usually it's served soft, and that's because it has a low fat content and it's creamier in your mouth.
Okay.
So that's a general, but you'll find, and I think if you want to, there's a book, Nick Malgeri did a book on Italian desserts, and he's got some good gelato recipes.
Okay.
Now, who are you making this for? You have a restaurant?
Yeah, the 6th Street Bistro. We're in Hood River. And
Hood River where?
Hood River, Oregon.
Ah.
I have to tell you, this is just a special part of the country. We have the most amazing local ingredients and
are you guys the fruit? You're in the fruit area, I'll bet.
Yeah, well, we've got great pears and apples, but the ice cream argument stemmed from a discussion over huckleberry ice cream. And we have local huckleberries and blackberries that people bring to us at the restaurant. So that's where the debate came from.
I'm shaking my head because it's like it's unfair. But hey, Ben, thanks. It was a great. It's a great question because I think I'm always confused about this. But that's what I know so far.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your opinion. Thanks very much.
Goodbye, Ben.
Okay. Bye.
We should all have such problems. Okay, let's get back to the phones. The number's 800-537-5252. And we have Rena on the line. Rena, what's on your mind?
Hello, Lynn. I'm happy to have a question on your program. I love your show.
Oh, thanks.
I belong to a gourmet dinner club.
Right.
And the theme next month is a 70s party. And all the 70s stuff is coming back, and we're thinking, oh, we know the music to play, and we know how we're going to dress, and we're all excited. And
get those bell bottoms out there, let me tell you.
And we're having trouble figuring out what our menu should be. And my mother had kept all of her gourmet magazines from the 70s. So my girlfriend and I drug those out, we're going through them, and we're looking at everything, and we're thinking, everything has got a sauce on it, it's so heavy and creamy, and it could be really hot and steamy outside, and so we don't want to do anything that's too heavy. And I thought maybe you could help us come up with a menu.
Well, you may want to move it to January.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, but it's really, when you say 70s, I have to tell you, fat meant nothing then. We didn't know what the word cholesterol meant. Okay, let's see now. 70s. All right, what was typical of the 70s? There were creamy, dreamy things, like, for instance, green goddess dressing and chicken and tuna in tonnato sauce, which is mayo and lots of lemon and tuna pureed together with onion and whatever. I'd almost make that a dip. By the way, it was dip heaven back then.
Oh, okay.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, if you could dip into it, you made it. It was incredible. I remember something that isn't going to be tough in hot weather. Whole cold poached fish. And what you did, okay, you poach, I mean, like a big salmon, head on, by the way.
Okay.
The reason you leave the head on the fish is when the eye turns white, real white, the fish is probably just about done, and that's the time to test it.
Okay.
Good thing to just remember on general principle. But anyway, whole poached fish, you poach it in a fish broth. Okay.
Okay.
And you can, that's white wine. Take some fish bones, celery, carrot, onion, simmer that all together for 30 minutes, strain it, and that's it. Okay.
Okay.
You need a fish poacher. Your mother probably has one of those.
All right.
Yep. And by the way you do this is you measure the poacher and then you go out and measure the fish. Because there are many people who can tell you stories of coming home with the fish and discovering you have nothing big enough to poach it in.
Okay.
So, anyway, poaching is where you have the water barely shimmying, you know, not boiling. Once the fish is done, you pull it out, you let it cool, you chill it completely, you lay it on a big platter, you pull off the skin, and if it's a salmon, of course, you're going to get this bright pink flesh. It's going to be gorgeous. And then one trick you can use is you can use a little bit of mayonnaise, not a lot, that you flavor with fresh dill or any fresh herb you like. Chives or whatever, and lemon, put a thin coat of that over the fish flesh, and then thin slice cucumbers. You can use one of those inexpensive mandolins you can buy, you know, to thin slice, and lay the cucumber slices over the fish like scales.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
It is gorgeous. And it's the kind of thing you do the whole thing ahead. You serve it chilled. And the sauce with it usually was some kind of flavored herbal mayonnaise. But you could easily thin out that sauce with yogurt and a little bit of sour cream, and you would have something that's dynamite.
Oh,
and then with that, I do some cold marinated salads, but using things like oil and vinegar, fresh herbs, maybe garlic. You know what I'm saying? Things that are not going to be heavy with creamy tasting things.
Okay.
Yeah. And dessert classic back in the 70s was the fruit tart, fresh fruit tart.
Oh.
Sugar cookie crust, homemade pastry cream, easy to do because you can do each component ahead and then assemble it the day of the party.
Oh, that sounds great.
And it's beautiful, and you can use all kinds of seasonal berries. Just pile them on in clusters. You know, the northwest corner is the strawberries, and the southwest corner are the raspberries, and so on and so forth.
Right. Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, so there you go. It's not too bad, and you won't have the cholesterol count that'll, you know, kill you all. I'm amazed we all survived.
I guess so.
Yeah, we made it, though. Hey, thanks, and have a great party.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
What I remember, when I think back, I mean this, you know, I can remember the heat of August, you know, 190 in the shade, humidity, and people serving beef Wellington. That's beef, you know, a fillet of beef with pate over it, and then it's baked in a heavy crust with lots of butter in it. It's amazing we survived. Okay, we've got Frank on the line. Frank, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, I've got a question about New Mexico green and red chili. We lived in New Mexico for about 7 years.
You lucky person. Where were you?
In Santa Fe.
Oh, nirvana. Okay.
Yeah, especially for chili lovers.
Yes, exactly.
And we recently moved out, and something struck me that green chili is always used fresh, red chili is always used dry. Why doesn't anyone ever use the red chilies fresh? It's the same chili, just ripe, but I think you know that.
Yeah, exactly. And it also tastes richer when it's ripe. Right,
right, but I've never seen it used fresh. It's always used dried there.
You know, that is... Well, I'll tell you what my response is to that. Duh. I think part of the reason is that it probably, I'm going back a long time ago before refrigeration and modern transport, I would bet that a ripe chili spoiled really fast. And as you know, you can ride out into the countryside outside of Santa Fe in the fall when the chilies are ripe. And one of the most stunning sights to me is that intense blue of that New Mexico sky, the white adobe buildings, and those great strings of bright red, freshly harvested ripe chilies that are drying in that hot, dry climate. And I think it may have had to do originally with spoilage. But I think if you live in a place where you can get the fresh chilies right off of the plant, you know, or you can get them in the market, I think a fresh red chili would be absolutely luscious. There's only one other thing I wonder about. Maybe the skin gets very tough.
Well, it's pretty tough on the green, and you know,
yeah, and you roast it. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, of course, there in August and September, the smell is wonderful all through Santa Fe.
Oh yeah, it's I think of it as the perfume of Santa Fe. I mean,
exactly.
if I could dab it behind my ears, I'd wear it all year. But for those of you who haven't lived in the Southwest, this idea of green and red chilies is really it's a great question, because usually fresh chilies that are called for in recipes are the green ones, and the red ones are always dried. I think it was a matter of, in the old days, people got used to this, but essentially it was keeping. By the way, did you know that there's an organization called the International Connoisseurs of Green and Red Chilies? And their salute at their meetings, everyone gets a big green Anaheim chili. And their salute, you raise your chili up like the Statue of Liberty holding the torch, and you say, up your pod. And that is your salute. And you can join. Anybody can join the International Connoisseurs of Green and Red Chili. And each chapter has a president, and they are called the Queso Grande, or the Big Cheese.
Right.
Yes, this group does not take itself terribly seriously, but it does take chili seriously.
Well,
but anyway, that's my speculation about
it. Okay. Okay, so I've actually never tried eating a fresh red chili. I should try that.
Oh, they're great.
I mean, I love the powdered red chili, you know, the question
yeah,
about
but you never went up into the Española Valley and just,
oh, yeah,
when
yeah.
they harvested and just bit?
Yeah, but I never just grabbed one.
Oh, where are you living now?
Now we're living in Seattle.
Boy, talk about a contrast.
Yeah.
Oy vey, from constant sunlight to rain.
Actually, this is our first year here. We've been really lucky. It's been a real dry year, so it's a good transition. More rain than we're used to,
and
but less than normal.
And you guys have salmon and coffee. What more?
Exactly, starting to... explore that. Being near seafood is really nice.
Hey, thanks for the call, Frank.
Okay.
Hope we helped.
All right, thank you.
You can get to us, by the way. You can get to us in a lot of ways, but one of the ways is call 800-537-5252. Okay, we've got Beth on the line. So, Beth, what do you want to talk about?
Lynn, I shop a lot at a food co-op near my home, and I've recently noticed that maple syrup seems to come in two grades, A and B.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to know a little bit about what the difference is between the grades, which one particularly would have a more hearty flavor, and how I could use these in cooking.
Oh. Did you rehearse that question?
No.
You are so organized, woman. This is really great. That's true. And evidently, I'm not a maple syrup expert, but it does come in A and B, and I actually think there's a C or a double A. Here's all that I can find in my brain about maple syrup. the lower the grade, I think the darker and richer it tastes. So if you get a B, it's going to be darker and more intense. And for my money, I love it. I think the higher the letter, you know, like an A or a double A, it's more delicate and refined, and that's for the fancy pants folks. But for us hardy types, I would say go for B, double B. There's also something called dark amber. But they and they also stand up in cooking, aside from putting them on flapjacks. So that's what I would go for. And as far as using it in cooking, it's tough to use maple syrup as a substitute for sugar because some baking recipes sort of go a little crazy. But what you can do, I mean, with great maple syrup, I use it with a little bit of soy sauce and garlic. Try basting meats with it, like pork. You know, in the fall, couldn't that be just incredible? Or spare ribs? And the other thing is fold it into whipped cream and put it on fruits. So that it's that sort of thing. Saute things like fresh peaches and sprinkle them with a little maple syrup. Just put them in a hot pan with a bit of butter, you know, real hot. Sear them on the outside, sprinkle them with maple syrup, turn them twice, and get them out of the pan and eat them for dessert.
That sounds like I need to have those with some good vanilla ice cream.
I think this is a good idea. And in fact, it sounded so good to me, I want to go home and make it right now.
That sounds like a plan. Thank you so much.
Hey,
we love your show.
Thanks a lot.
All right, bye-bye.
Goodbye. You know, this business about maple syrup, this is a case where cheap is good. Look for there's if you go to Vermont, you know, or where they have lots of maple trees, you'll see things like dark amber, medium dark amber, light amber, grade A, grade double A, double B, triple C. And I have a feeling part of this comes from the different kinds of maple trees they get the syrup from, because there's different sap from different maples. And also maybe it has to do with when in the season the sap is taken. But try playing around with maple syrup. It's really good stuff. Well, that's it for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The answering machine loves to hear from you. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with a comment from Paul Newman. He said, "The embarrassing thing is that the salad dressing has outgrossed my films." Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, offering the latest cooking tools and gadgets, from colanders to ladles to timers and garlic crushers. Target has the selection of cooking tools to fully outfit your kitchen. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lupke and Jennifer Russell. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Minnesota Public Radio. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.